Hard questions are asked in our reading for today. Questions that have no good answers. What wrong did Israel's ancestors find in me that they went far from me? God asks through Jeremiah. How can it be that they would choose worthless things instead of me? How can it be that this people that I shepherded through the wilderness and brought into this beautiful land could have forgotten me? Wouldn't even think to ask in their time of distress, where has that God gone off to? They didn't even think to ask or bother to go searching for an answer to that question. Even the priests, even the kings, the sons of David, even the prophets, they all just plain forgot me or exchanged me in favor of lesser things. I have never seen such a thing. Has a nation ever just exchanged who it worships, who it follows like that? Has a people ever experienced such mass amnesia in this way? What happened to them? What has happened to the people that I cherished and nurtured in its infancy and childhood with a love so strong, with security and an inheritance and a place in the world? What has happened to them? Two evil and tragic things have happened here, Jeremiah says at the conclusions. My people have forsaken me, the fountain of living water, and dug out cisterns for themselves, cracked cisterns that can hold no water. They have dug out cracked cisterns for themselves instead of just drinking freely from the fountain of living water. Wow. That is an image worth thinking about. You know, the environment and the climate in ancient Israel is nothing like what we experience here on the east coast of North America. We've had a little rain this past week. More at least than we did for most of the summer. But Israel has a true rainy season, as well as a dry season. How many of you have ever lived in a place with a monsoon season before? Anyone ever lived in the Southwest, in Arizona maybe? In Israel, as hilly as it can be in the middle of the country, up in that high inland part, when the rainy season comes, it can come in a flash. All of that water hits those hills and floods come streaming down into the valleys. Water just gushing left and right, and they pool up in the low places called wadis. And all of a sudden, where there was dry places just a month before, deserts really, all of a sudden there are lakes and water everywhere. And so to prepare for that reality and to take advantage of it as much as possible, what people would do, especially in the more central parts of the countries, is that they would dig these massive holes in the grounds, almost caverns, really. The bigger and the deeper, the better. Oftentimes, these cisterns would have spiral cases, staircases along the inside of them going way, way down so that you could get down to where the water is, lower and lower throughout the year. You'd have to keep them uncovered in the rainy season so that the water could get in, but cover them up in the hot season so that it wouldn't evaporate. And you'd have to plaster those walls well so that the water you collected would stay put and not seep into the ground. That's what a cistern is, really. A plastered, underground water collection pit. It's a bore in Hebrew. Can you imagine what a hardship, what an emergency it would be if the cistern was cracked? Think of all that water. All of that water for yourselves, for your family, your flocks, your plants maybe. All of it just seeping away into the ground. What are we going to do now? A cracked cistern is worse than no good. It's deadly. It portends suffering for a family. It signals that loss and hard times are coming. All of that water slipping away into the ground and no way to stop it. That's the image that Jeremiah puts before us today, a people that has rejected never-ceasing fountains of living water, fresh, running water, in favor of stale, murky cistern water slowly escaping into the ground. Why would anyone do that? Why would anyone endanger themselves like that? How does a people lose its ability to taste the difference between the two? To see and experience the difference in quality between those two options? The true challenge of Jeremiah's ministry as a prophet, I think, is to remind a people of what they've forgotten. To remind a people what they've given up. To figure out how to convert their taste buds back to the water source that's much, much fresher and in vastly more abundant supply. To plead with and to show his people through any means possible just where they are and what it means to shock them into an emergency, if necessary. To reawaken the eyes of their dulled consciences so that what has been lost can start to be rebuilt again from the inside out. Oh, Jeremiah, what a challenging call that is. The spark of a national reawakening put on the shoulders of his solitary ministry, and the stakes are nothing short of a looming national catastrophe. This sort of thing that we read here today, this sort of warning and pleading, comprises much of Jeremiah's ministry, especially in the first half of his career. And today, I just want to explore with you in what way this part of Jeremiah's hope, this part is part of Jeremiah's hope-filled ministry, a necessary part of his proclaiming hope from the ashes. I have to admit, though, on the surface, what's being said here and throughout these early chapters doesn't sound all that hopeful on first reading. There's a fair bit of warning, a fair amount of tragedy and doom and gloom in there. Where is the hope in that? You might ask fairly. What does all of this angst and negativity we encounter in this book have to do with hope and a positive future? Are the building and the planting the only hopeful parts of his ministry, or are not the tearing down and the plucking up hope-filled in their own way as well? I don't know if you followed this story in the news, but I was really interested recently in the Artemis space launch that was scheduled for earlier this month. They were touting the Artemis as the most powerful rocket ever built. And it was supposed to have been the first deep space flight of a capsule built for astronauts in some 50 years or so. clearly a sign of our intention to try and go deeper and deeper into space, visit new planets like Mars perhaps, discover new things. The plan was to send the rocket out for a loop around the moon and back, and as far as I understand, bring it back to the Earth to test it in orbit at several different orbital distances, and eventually to have it splash down there in the Pacific Ocean, just like in those early and exciting years of spaceflight. For me, part of the reason I was so interested in it is that it felt like we were simultaneously taking this giant step into the future, while at the same time there was a great deal of nostalgia for the past in there somewhere. But as you probably know, they canceled the launch. They canceled it with just 2.5 hours remaining until the launch. It was something having to do with a fuel leak or a hydrogen cooling system malfunction. If I could explain it, I'd be working for NASA right now. In any case, it's probably a great idea to cancel a launch if you think you have a fuel leak, or if you think you're not going to be able to cool the rockets that can get up to 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Probably a great idea, right? And you know what caught my ear as I was reading a little about this story is the vast difference in attitudes over the scrub between the media and the public on the one hand, and NASA and the astronauts on the other. The public and the media, well, they're understandably a bit disappointed. They wanted to see a launch, right? They wanted to see this mission get moving, this new venture get off the ground. It's a little deflating to have all of that build up to the most powerful rocket ever built, and the first big step toward an eventual Mars trip, and then have it canceled at the very last minute. But NASA takes it all in stride. And not just in stride. When they interviewed astronauts that have had their flights scrubbed, they were often boiling over with positivity. Great job. I am so relieved. Excellent call. Let's not go before we're ready. They are experienced enough in this to celebrate every single sign of progress. Whether it's a successful launch or the fixes and the tweaks that are necessary precursors to a successful launch, the tearing down and the fixing and the starting afresh even, they see all of those as part of the process towards getting to that eventual successful launch. There are things that have got to be gotten right before they can get off the ground safely. They don't want to be going over 5,000 miles per hour in a rocket if everything isn't just the way it should be. And so they, for their part, seem to have learned to celebrate every single sign of progress. The tearing down and the fixing, as well as the building up. You know, that's what Jeremiah is up to here today and in a lot of his ministry. The tearing down and the fixing. The less flashy part of retooling the hearts of a people to move successfully toward a hope-filled future. There are things in Israel's heart that need fixing before they are ready to launch. Can they accept the part of the process, like those NASA astronauts do, as just as important a part of the process? Will they, unlike those NASA astronauts, view the fixing and the tearing down as somehow being the opposite of launching toward that hopeful future? The historical answer in this case is unfortunately yes. Yes, they did. But we don't have to repeat their mistakes. We can learn to hear what Jeremiah is saying through a different set of ears. All of this tearing down is a necessary part of being able to move well into a future that's better. And the people of Israel, for their part, are going to have to learn how to love the water that comes fresh from ever-flowing streams more than they do the water that is seeping away in those cracked cisterns. You know, a big part of growth in discipleship is learning to love the things that are good for us. There's heart work involved in that shift. There's transformation of both heart and mind. It involves an entire reorientation of our heart's desires. How is God going to teach my heart to love the things that are good for me? How's God going to teach my heart to love that living water that will never run out? Most of us struggle because we love things that are bad for us, right? We love things that are sometimes killing us. We love things that are killing our bodies, killing our relationships, our ability to relate to one another in small and large scales as God's beloved children. We, like the Israelites that Jeremiah is talking to, have so often learned to love those cracked cisterns that are pointing us toward ruin. And it's better, says Jeremiah, to scrub the launch of that ship and to make those fixes rather than to send it hurtling off into space towards certain doom. What's needed is a heart set free, right? What's needed is a heart that's turning to love what's good for it. A heart that's learned to love those living waters will never go thirsty. Jeremiah is trying his hardest to persuade us to let go of the broken one and to start working on the better one, because the hope of a better future will only be realized in the better one. That means that I've got to let my heart learn how to stop loving those idols and false gods. That means that I've got to let my heart hear these challenging words so that they'll stop forgetting and stop undervaluing the God who created me, the God who redeems me and sustains me. That means that my heart has to learn how to stop delighting in hatred and backbiting and revenge and all of that political animosity and racism and the prejudices of our time. My heart has to learn how to stop drinking from those broken cisterns. They're not life-giving. They're not life-giving. Jesus said to the woman at the well in John chapter 4, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that's asking you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Those who drink of the water that I give them will never be thirsty. The water that I give them will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." A spring. A spring of water in my heart, in your heart, a never-ceasing source of nourishment. Can we let go of those old broken cisterns and turn past the desire for evil that's starving our own souls and turn toward that ever-ready spring that's ready to feed with the things that are truly life-giving, truly nourishing. Jeremiah is hard at work trying to convince us to do just that, so that we can turn to God and be transformed by those living waters that God has in store for us. And all of God's people said, Amen.